A brain tumor diagnosis is a traumatic and life-changing event, resulting in altered priorities as part of a new normal way of life for a patient and their family. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance. Since 2005, we've been creating a dynamic global community for brain tumor patient advocacy organizations and others involved in the field of neuro-oncology. Through our worldwide experience and expertise, we've been working to improve the well-being and quality of life for patients and their families. We advocate for the best treatments, information, and support for brain tumor patients, offering them, their families, and caregivers hope wherever they live in the world. In this series, we'll be meeting some of those working in the field of neuro-oncology, the people who support patients and their families, and those who've been told they have a brain tumor. We'll learn how brain tumors have affected all of these people, often in surprising ways. Welcome to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. We begin our series with author and broadcaster Dr. Stuart Farramond from Trowbridge in England, who's been talking to our reporter Graham Seaman about his own experiences of living with a brain tumor, how it offered unexpected opportunities to do things he'd never have dreamt of before a diagnosis, what having the support of friends and family truly means. And as a science communicator, Dr. Stu shares his personal hopes for the future of neuroscience and surgery.
Stu, it's really lovely to meet you. Start off by telling us where you were and what you were doing before you were diagnosed with a brain tumour.
I was diagnosed probably 14 or 15 years ago now. At the time, I was working as a medical doctor in a hospital. It was diagnosed purely sort of by accident, by serendipity. I was having some tests for some other things. They decided to do an MRI scan of my brain to make sure that there's a little gland at the bottom of the brain called the pituitary gland, just to check that that was okay. So they scanned it and the pituitary was fine, but they found in the right frontal lobe of my brain a large, slowly growing tumour. It's called a glioma, or an astrocytoma is the proper medical name for it. It's a slow growing, incurable cancer. It was resected, it was taken out, had surgery. That left me with epilepsy afterwards. I tried going back to work, but suffered really badly with fatigue and with seizures. And so essentially, over a period of sort of 12, 18 months, I ended up having to step down from my career. I'd been working 3 or 4 years since graduating. Then essentially been in a long time of, should we call it remission, but very slowly growing, and it was found 2 or 3 years ago now to have been growing increasingly quickly. So I needed 18 months ago now to have more severe surgery. But essentially, when I was forced to leave medicine, I found another job teaching in a further education college. I sort of fell into that doing sciencey-based teaching stuff, the biology, the stuff that the kids actually thought was all quite boring. And when I was doing that, I discovered this huge thrill that you get from teaching people. Over 2 years, I could watch these young women turn into mature women and ready to go into a career or into university. So that kind of very much changed my life as a result of the brain tumour. From that, I sort of found another passion, which was sharing my love of science, which I just see as a way of understanding the amazing world that we have around us, to a greater number of people. I started doing some science writing. I started writing a blog, and this is back in the day when blogs were pretty unheard of. It was quite a new thing. So I started that, and it got picked up by a producer for a one-off documentary in the UK based around the Great British Biscuits, or if you're outside of the UK, it's a cookie. Us in the UK, we have this strange thing. We get our cookies, our biscuits, and we dunk them into our cup of tea. It's a very British thing. And they did this documentary focusing around a British TV celebrity chef called Nigel Slater. And they wanted a little sort of a science bit for this hour-long programme. So they found me that I'd been writing this science blog, one of which had been about the science of biscuit dunking. And so they got hold of me, they asked me to do it. And so they wheeled me out for this this TV program, white lab coat and all. As much as I said, can I please not wear a white lab coat? They insisted on doing all the cliches of the mad scientist in the science lab. And you know what, Graham, I really loved it. And it was the fact that you could communicate something in a way that people could understand to a large audience. And so I've kind of pursued that. I've pursued the writing. I've now written 3 books. The fourth one is on the cards. I've just started writing it now. Book about the science of cooking. Another book called The Science of Spice. And the third one's about the science of living, which is more of a sort of a return to my roots of explaining all those everyday things around us, using science, but using it in an easy, understandable way.
It's been a roller coaster for you, clearly, Stuart. But in the initial stages, of course, when you find out this news that you've got a brain tumour, I mean, what was the effect on your family, your friends, on you?
You know, often when people ask me this, I forget that it's not just me that goes through this. Me and my wife and my family, especially my wife, have been going through this probably now 15 years of just living with uncertainty, with facing your mortality right in front of you. And that, as somebody, what I was then in my mid-20s, is an unusual thing to have to face in our safe Western world. And so it brings up a lot of issues, a lot of stuff that often we put off. Those things like, what is my identity? Because if I have my profession taken away from me, then do I lose some of who I am, being known as the doctor? The neighbours on the street will know me as the doctor. What do I do with that? Who am I really? You discover about who you are. What is really important? How do you want to spend your days? You know, all of us, Graham, we've got a limited number of days on this planet, but it's only when you see it face to face that you have to face those decisions of, okay, this is real. My life on this planet Earth isn't indefinite. And it's really important that I spend my hours and my days and my weeks in a way that is right for me.
How does it affect your relationship with your friends? I mean, did you find that certain people found it difficult to know what to say or what to do when they heard what had happened to you?
I don't want to say you found out who your true friends are, but it's amazing how, and I've heard this from other people who've been diagnosed with life-limiting conditions like cancer, often there's people who you didn't feel were very close friends that sort of come out of the woodwork and they go the extra mile and they're there for you and they support you. A lot of people don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. They feel awkward. And so they default to the, whenever they see you, they say, how are you doing? How's your health? And that just is so annoying, if I'm honest, because it just diminishes you to being the person with the brain tumour. And actually, you know, having had the brain tumour and having had my career that I thought was going to be for my life stripped away from me, I'm actually now, I know myself as Stuart, as Dr. Stu, or as Stu. And actually, I'm my own person. I'm the person who loves my wife very much. I like cycling. I like going to nice restaurants. I like travelling when I can. I love seeing friends. There's loads of things that I do. I'm not the man with the brain tumour. There's very much a sort of a split in how people react or not. And I think what I learn about this is that when you go through these really tough, horrible times of operations and seizures, and most recently I had a much more involved surgery that was problematic recovery, coming for 2 years now, and essentially had to relearn how to use my left hand, how to hold a cup, how to use knives and forks, how to type, you know, how to walk safely, all these things I had to relearn. And to see the effect of that on my wife, it's very moving, and I often get emotional with the fact that it's not just me that goes through this, it's others that go through it with me. But I think the sense of people who are true friends in this, they just come alongside you and they just say, look, I can't sort this out for you, but I'm here for you. You know, whatever I can do to help, I'm here for you. If you want somebody just to talk to, if you need me to help with practical wise, then that's great. The onus is not on you to sort of fill their needs in terms of this is me and I'm going to be the brain tumor patient and woe is me, but it's about building that, I guess, that relationship with these people, because ultimately these horrible things that happen to us, they can be amazing opportunities, as I found in my own life. One of the things that we have found through all of this is that you don't do this on your own and you need people with you. I've for a long time gone to church, and I would say that the church family that I have, they are a family. When I've been for operations and things, every day there's been food prepared for us by somebody in the church. You know, the people asking how you are, but in an honest and caring and compassionate way, not a how's the brain tumour, how you sort of the glib things that so many of us feel that we've got to say. You know, my faith is quite personal to me, but I would say that it gives you an inner strength. Most of us, or our loved ones, will have those dreaded times of the phone calls of you've got something not very nice going on with you and you're faced with this uncertainty. And it's in those very black times that actually, if you've got something to draw upon, if you've got a faith to draw upon, it gives you an extra resilience, extra strength. Now, I'm not going to evangelize about my faith. I can only be honest for what it has meant to me, is that it gives me a strength. It gives me an inner peace.
You talk about the books. There's been an emphasis on cooking, but the science of living in particular, that must have been quite close to you because it is about our bodies. It's about the way we look after ourselves. How much do you think what has happened to you influenced the way that was put together?
Yeah, so the first book was called The Science of Cooking, and that is essentially because my biscuit dunking exploits landed me in a sort of a food science niche. And off the back of that, the publisher, Dorling Kindersley, got in touch with me and said, we love what you're doing. We want to write this book about the science of cooking. Are you interested? To which I said, yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, I'd actually, reflecting on it after the fact, I remembered that when I was a student at university, I got really into sort of cooking shows and understanding the science behind cooking. And I even picked up some old notes of some newspaper cuttings that I remember sort of storing up of these are interesting things I want to write about a science of cooking, a science of food book at some point. So it was really like my dream came true just out of the blue. So I wrote the first book with them. The second book was along a similar lines because the first book had been so unexpectedly successful. It was about the science of spice. So more of a sort of a foodies, a cook's book. And then they came back to me and said, what would you like to do? It'd be nice to have something that you want to write from your heart. Why can't I have a book about everything? About all those I wonder why questions that I have throughout the day? They sort of looked at me a bit bemused. I'm like, how is that going to work? And I said, you could split up into like a clock going through your day. Like you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, why do I find it so hard to get up in the morning? Is there an answer for that? When's the best time to have my first cup of coffee? Should I brush my teeth before or after I've had breakfast? All these silly little things that you think about that you wonder. And actually when you answer those questions, they reveal a whole load of really interesting, fascinating science that unpicks who we are and about our world and about our bodies. And they went for it. They said, that's a great idea. My most serious operation to date, I'll say, hopefully it's the most serious one I'll ever have, which was, as I say, about 2 years ago. That was right in the middle of writing this book. The publishers, they were really great because they could have said, we want the advance back now. We're going to pull the plug. But they didn't. They said, you know, we will put the publishing date on hold and it will get done when it gets done. And so the book did get done. So that my experiences of that, and then obviously entering the pandemic, which has a sort of a strange irony to it, because I noticed that all of a sudden, everybody around me was going, oh my gosh, I've got to face my mortality here. There's a deadly virus out there that might kill me and might kill my friends. And at the time when it first kicked off, I was on chemotherapy and so I was shielding. And so I was quite used to not going out. So this profound thing of not going out, of life's being under threat, that was kind of par for the course for me at that time. Realizing that it does give you an opportunity, the pandemic, to reflect again on what's important with your life, because I won't pretend that it hasn't affected me much like it has everybody else. And I wrote about it in the preface of the book. This is sort of risen up out of what my life has thrown at me, and I explain that very briefly. It's about how can we make the best of our lives? How can we have happier, healthier, more productive, more generous lives?
Now, of course, this series is all about positivity. It's about hope. It has opened a door for you, all of this, hasn't it? And given you a new direction. How do you view that? How do you now reflect on that?
Has it changed my life in a good way? Yes, I think it has. But to be honest, Graham, I don't like the fact that every 3 months I have to go and have a brain scan to find out if and when this brain tumour has come back, because they tell me, you know, and I see all the data that it will come back and it will kill me at some point. And one of the difficult things is that I'm faced with is that every month I write for the International Brain Tumour Alliance alongside Kathy, who's the chair of the IBTA, the International Brain Tumour Alliance, the e-news, which is a monthly email newsletter that goes out to the 6,000 or so subscribers. And it goes out to doctors, researchers, nurses, patients, carers, caregivers, the whole gamut of people. And every month I go through all the brain tumour research that has come out, brain tumour events and news, all that sort of stuff. I go through it all and we whittle it down into a list. But I know from having spoken to people just when I've been to see my consultants, they often get the e-news. And some of them have said that this is actually the most important thing that I get each month for summarising the news. And that's a great challenge for me because I'm having to pull upon all my sort of writing abilities and communication skills to be able to put these lofty concepts into sort of everyday language, and that isn't patronising to researchers, but is still understandable to the you and I's of this world. I bring that up because every month I look at the state of play with brain tumour treatments. And unfortunately, it's not good at the moment, Graham. It's not brilliant. It's not moved on a heck of a lot in the last 20 to 30 years. Life expectancy for the most aggressive type of brain tumour called a glioblastoma or a grade 4 type of tumour isn't much improved in the last 20 or 30 years. Mine is at a grade 3, what's known as an anaplastic astrocytoma, so it's not at the most aggressive stage, although everything says that it's going to grow to the more aggressive stage. And when you get to that point, you're just buying yourself a little bit of extra time. So yes, I can contribute hugely to other people's lives, and it's a real honour to be able to do this e-news for all these people. There is some good stuff coming out there. I wish it was coming faster. There's all sorts of things like there's immunotherapies, which is using your body's own immune system to train it to attack the cancer that's in your head. There's all these exciting things going on, but it's a very mixed picture. It's a sort of living with this horrible uncertainty that every 3 months, every season, my wife and I have to go over to hospital to have my scan. And then we have to wait another couple of weeks to find out the results. Is our life going to be turned upside down again? Am I going to have more radiotherapy, chemotherapy, surgery? What is next? I hate that. I hate it. I hate the fact that if I make it to my 50s, I'm doing well. That I look in my wife's eyes and that I know that she is always fearing that I'm going to leave her before she leaves this planet. And that, you know, Graham, that breaks my heart. But in my day-to-day existence, I feel that my life is much fuller. I can give more for other people. I have more peace with the world and with other people.
The thing is, Stuart, you are a professional doctor and you know what's going on in the world of medicine. And then you are meeting professionals who are trying to help you. How does that relationship work?
Yeah, it's odd. It's really odd from being a doctor to being a patient, is that you understand all this stuff that's going on in your brain, in your body, and yet that's you all of a sudden. And so I'm really kind of conflicted that there's this fascination about what's going on in my body. And when I see the doctors who are now treating me, and some of them were once my colleagues, it's very strange.
What's your message to anybody, Stuart, at the moment who's just discovered and been told that they have a brain tumour?
Yeah, I would say hope. Never lose hope. And hope can be for whatever you want it to be honest. But whatever that is, never lose hope. And take people with you. Don't do it on your own. People ask me how I've done it. But to be honest, I was able to relearn how to make a cup of tea, to cook in the kitchen again. Yes, there's a certain part that was just my stubbornness and my belligerence to keep at it, but I wouldn't have had that unless I'd had family and friends supporting me and loving me and urging me on. So I would say do it with others.
And finally, Stuart, what would be your message to those who work in the field of brain tumours?
My message would be, as somebody who is now a passionate, what I would call a science communicator, I got to admit that, and as a former doctor, I've had some fantastic care, but I've also had some people who still can't communicate on an even platform. And unfortunately, when I go to consultations, my wife isn't at all medical. She's not at all interested in medicine. They won't speak in a way that she can understand. You know, acute and chronic, they're classic examples. When you say you've got a chronic abdominal pain, oh, that means I've got terrible pain in my abdomen. But actually, what they're saying is it's chronic means it's going on a long time. You know, you're a brain tumor patient. No, I'm not. I'm a person who's been diagnosed with a brain tumor. It's things like that. It's just make yourself as if you're in a pub with a mate talking to somebody. Don't bury yourself in this jargon. Care for your patients and do it with being honest and open and using the most straightforward language that you can.
Dr. Stuart Farriman, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Our reporter, Graham Seaman, talking to Dr. Stuart Farriman from Trowbridge in England. In our next episode, from a Mexican migrant worker who couldn't speak a word of English to becoming an eminent neurosurgeon, cancer researcher, and author, we'll be hearing from Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa, who's professor and chair of the Department of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Q, as he's known, will be sharing his unique and remarkable story and his thoughts on why we should be optimistic about the future of neuroscience and medicine. So do join us for the next in our IBTA podcast series, A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. I'm Kathy Oliver, chair and co-director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance. And if you'd like to find out more about the work we do, just go to our website at theibta.org. Thanks for listening. This has been a GS Media production for the IBTA.